Hi, and welcome to Macro Monday, where we talk macro and try to make sense of markets that get panic bid on the day before earnings announcement. And that makes no sense to me. I'm your host, Steve Van Meter, and today we're going to do something a little different than normal. You know, I want to go through the quarterly report for Hoisington Investment Management. Now, if you've never heard of Hoisington, why would we even look at them? Is because this is where Dr. Lacey Hunt, who is by far one of the foremost experts on the bond market, he manages money for them. He's a long-only institutional U.S. Treasury bond manager. Long-only meaning they don't short the bond market. They're only long. And depending on what's going on in the market, they will either be very long duration or out the duration curve or very short. They never take a short position against the bond market. And as you know, because you've been watching this show for a long time, that Dr. Hunt is one of the foremost experts on the bond market, someone whose research I study. In fact, every quarter when he puts out his quarterly report, I read it at least three times. And if any chance I can hear him speak, I listen to it at least once. So there's two people that I look to for their expertise in the bond market, and mainly because it's grounded in the monetary system. He's one of them. Jeff Snyder's the other. And there are some other people, such as Dr. Werner, that don't publish quite as often, but there are some other experts when it comes to bonds. Dr. Hunt is the foremost expert on that, and his research really matters. So what I want to do is go through his report. I'm going to link it for you in the report, because in the kingdom, this is required reading. And in fact, if you're wondering why there's no crown today, well, the bond market was closed. So how can you wear the crown when the bond market is closed? But how I came to find Dr. Hunt's research is actually fairly interesting, because when I had built my macro thesis, the first phase of that was we were going to see deflation. And in a deflationary environment, you know, as I like to say, that treasury bonds are a layup. They're a layup play. You know how they're going to perform because you know what's going to happen. Interest rates are going to fall during deflation. Bond prices are going to rise. It's an easy deal. But I needed to know more. And the problem with the bond market is there are a lot of opinions, a substantial amount of opinions. But in terms of experts, there's very few people that really, truly understand it. So what I did after I kind of built out my thesis is I went looking to find who those experts were. And I want to encourage you to do the same thing as you build your investment thesis, whatever it may be, is you need to go out and find who knows the most about whatever sectors or whatever part of your thesis that says invest in a certain way and locate them. And it doesn't mean just going out and finding people that are bullish or bearish. And you need to find the people who are absolutely the experts. And Lacey is one of those. So let me show you how we find his report. And then we're going to actually go through pieces of it. I've got some graphs for you. And I think it's really interesting to try and understand this, because I've been reading his reports before they were actually made public. Now, you can go to his website at Hoisington Investment Management, and there's an economic overview, and you can see they have been publishing these publicly since 2017. Now, I was able to get some of them prior to that when he would release them through some of his friends. And so here's the actual report, and let's just go through pieces of this. And I know somebody's saying, well, I can read this too. Yes, I understand that. But I want to just identify some very key points along the way in case you choose not to print it out or maybe have time later. And so what he first starts is there's a very powerful secular downdraft has occurred in the major measures of economic performance, secular being long-term downdraft. Now, how would we go and look at that? Well, we could see, well, we'll look at that in a second. Let's look at the second point, and then we'll go look at the slide I have. Is the U.S. is caught in a debt trap, a term originated by the Bank for International Settlements. It's a condition where too much debt weakens growth, which elicits a policy response that creates more debt that results in even more disappointing business conditions. Now, how can we figure that out? Well, I've got on this chart the total total public debt inverted against gross domestic product on a year-over-year basis. And what we can see is that there was a point where the debt actually kind of did cause some growth here in the 90s, but going into the 2000s, we've added debt and we have not seen an increase in GDP growth. In fact, what we've been able to do is keep it from going down further. So we can see GDP growth during the last cycle was running around 6.5% at near its peak. And now with more debt, we could barely get it up to say 4.5%. So we keep adding debt and we get less and less growth. So as he mentions in that debt trap there. So further, he goes on to say, is debt finance fiscal programs only boost the economy in the very short run, but eventually reduce growth in the longer term? We're going to look at that as well. And then he goes on to say the secular deterioration in economic growth has created a condition of excess resources and disinflation. So what that means is there's too many resources in the economy, and that leads to disinflation. It's something we've talked about and done videos on in the past, is the workings of the Fisher equation, which have brought treasury bond yields lower, have been reinforced by a sharp decline in the marginal revenue product of debt. So let's go take a look at some of these things. And we'll start over here on the right, secular erosion. He talks about how things are getting worse as we add in more debt. So you look at real per capita GDP is started out, with an average in the 1940s through 80s at 3.1%, is now down to 1.6. Look at non-farm payroll employment, went from 2.8 during that prior period down to 1.4. How about population? We saw a population growth about 1.4%, and now it's at half at 0.7. And then productivity used to be quite high at 2.4, and now we're half that at 1.2. So as we add debt, we're not getting the growth out of it that we used to get. And that's pretty important. And I want you to think about that, because what are we doing right now? Well, we're adding debt. And so he calls this the debt trap. And he said this concept is consistent with research which indicates that high debt levels undermine economic growth. And again, we just see that in this GDP chart here, where adding more debt. See, everyone thinks, we hear this in the markets, stimulus optimism, stimulus hopes, more debt, because we're finally going to get growth out of it. And the reality is we're adding massive amounts of debt to get less growth. So yes, the debt is keeping things from falling apart. The problem is we're not getting much out of all this debt. And over the long run, more debt leads to weaker growth. And we see here historical declines in economic growth rates have coincided with record levels of public and private debt. And then he goes on down here to say total public and private debt jumped from 167.2 in GDP in 1980 to 364 in 2019, with an estimated record of 405% at the end of this year. That is ridiculous. And this will be relevant later on. Gross government debt as a percent of GDP is estimated to be 127% by the end of this calendar year. So hang tight to that 127% number. So he talks about asymmetric central bank powers. And this is something we have talked about on this show many, many, many times. And I just want you to see here, coming from the foremost expert on the bond market, he says first, so he talks about quantitative easing first. The Fed must be able to control the monetary base by increasing its liabilities, which are assets of depository institution. This is indeed quantitative easing. And we know the Fed can raise and lower the monetary base by quantitative easing or tightening. So when they do QE, the monetary base goes up. When they do QT, the monetary base goes down. So the first thing the central bank can do is just that. So he mentions this is part of their central bank powers that they must be able to do to stimulate economic growth. So that is one of them. So the Fed is doing that. But hang tight. If you think that's the answer, wait for it. The second requirement of the Fed's power to stimulate economic conditions is a stable relationship between the monetary base and the money supply, or M2. This is the money multiplier, which is defined as the M2 divided by the monetary base, is the measure of that stability. Of course, this is something we also look at. Used to be every other week. Now it is once a month, but here is the money multiplier. And it needs to be stable. Well, where's a good example? We can see here between, say, the 1995 and, all the way to, that was not what I intended to click on. So let's back that up and zoom back Al, so you can see that. I had all these charts all set up, and let's see, that'll do it. Let's zoom that back out. So from 1995 and 2006, the money multiplier was stable. This is what we want to see. We also saw it fairly stable through 2014 through 2016, but he said this needs to be stable. It is not stable at all. And what that means is, due to the Fed's quantitative easing, over time, the monetary base should grow faster than the M2. So what he's saying in this report is they need to be stable. They need to be rising at the same point, meaning, very simply, we need to be see people saving money, continuing to save money. So everyone says, oh, the rise in M2 is really inflationary. Well, according to Dr. Hunt, not necessarily. The relation needs to be stable, and it is not. Let's continue on. Next, he talks about the velocity of money, and it needs to be stable, although not constant. It's really not possible to make this thing constant, but let's go take a look at the velocity of money, and you can see constant is not in its library. It was constant between 1995 and, say, 2000, but the velocity of money has slowed way down. So that isn't happening. Now, many people have said the velocity of money is going to increase, and they are right. And when we overlay the labor force participation rate, you can see there was a rebound in the labor market off the lows. We know that to be true because people went back to work. And so we should expect to see a rebound in the velocity of money. But as the labor force participation rate peaks and rolls over, guess what's going to happen with the velocity of money? It too is going to roll over. You can't get one without the other. So that's important. And the fourth piece is the Fed must have a wide latitude to lower the short-term policy interest rates. So it has long been recognized that if short-term rates approach the zero bound, monetary capabilities would be diminished. So if we look at all three of those, we know that the Fed can do QE. We know that the money multiplier is not stable. We know the velocity of money is not stable. And we know the Fed can't lower rates any more than they are doing it now. Four decades ago, the consensus view was all these conditions prevailed and monetary policy was a potent tool, if not only of not only restraining economic growth, but also stimulating economic growth. So all he's saying here is depending on how central bankers use these tools, they could restrain or create they could restrain the economy or create growth. Currently, of these four conditions, only the first one prevails and is the least important of the four. So that we know the Fed can continue doing quantitative easing, but because it has tapped out the other three, meaning the velocity of money is too slow, the money multiplier is falling, and it cannot cut short-term rates any lower than it is, it's not going to be effective at all. Thus, monetary policy is left with a one-sided capabilities. They can restrain economic activity by reducing reserve and raising rates, but they are not capable of stimulating economic activity to any significant degree. So here again, anybody who believes the Fed has this magical power to stimulate the economy, they don't. And if you remember, you know, what has Powell been talking about every time he gets in front of a microphone? I need more fiscal. Why is he saying that? Because monetary policy is tapped out. They have nothing left in the bag. Now, he says the Fed can stabilize distressed financial markets through their powerful lending abilities. We know that because they have been buying corporate and junk bonds, although they're not buying nearly as much as they can or have in the past. Now, if we go on to debt finance fiscal programs, because this is a hot topic right now of, well, if we get more fiscal stimulus, it will be lead to economic growth. And debt finance fiscal policy can provide a short-term lift to the economy that lasts 1 to 2 quarters. So think back of when we got this big fiscal back in March, right? So we have all March, April, May, June, July, August. So, you know, and that fiscal came in the months following March, between March, April, and May. So August, September, October. So it's pretty much tapping out. And what are we seeing in the economic data? You know, this is why I look at the economic data, because I said when all this fiscal hit that it would be transitory, and what are we seeing in the data? You know, we talked about this last week. We're seeing it start to peak and roll over, and there you see right in Dr. Hunt's research, he is validating that is what's going on. Let's move down here to where he says this multi-trillion dollars borrowed for pandemic relief in the second quarter encouraged the beginnings of a V-shaped recovery, but this additional debt will serve as a persistent restraint on growth going forward. When government debt as a percent of GDP rises above 65%, remember that I said hang on to that number from before, and I will get that for you. It is 127% is where we're currently at. So when government debt as a percent of GDP rises above 65%, economic growth is severely impacted and becomes very acute at 90%. We're going to close the year out somewhere around 127, meaning more debt is not going to create growth. It actually acts as a hindrance. So he goes on to talk about, hey, disinflation, a popular topic on this show here. Secular deterioration in economic growth of a large amount of unused resources and negative foreign conditions has led to a dramatic fall in the inflation rate. Now, obviously, we've gone on and on about this as a topic, and he pretty much sums it up by saying, look, I don't care what metric you use. Let's take a look at the scorecard. And he goes back to, again, to 1940 to 80, and we'll compare that to the average 2010s. And the consumer price index was running at a 4.3% rate. Now it's at 1.8. Personal consumption expenditures were at 4.2, now they're at 1.6. Excluding food and energy, core PCE was at 4.1, it's now at 1.6. The percent of the output gap that is negative for the decade is 78%, and the average output gap for the decade is at minus 2. So there is just no growth going on here. These are all disinflationary trends. Let's go to the next page. And again, you can read through the rest of this. I just wanted to point out some of these key parts for you. The Fisher equation and marginal revenue product of debt. Now, this is very interesting. Of all the things I cannot chart, and believe me, I take everything he puts out and I try to chart it, this MRP, I can't do it. If you can figure out how to do it, let me know. Falling real yields and inflationary expectations via the Fisher equation force government risk-free bond yields lower. What? Wait a second. That is ridiculous. I thought interest rates could only go up. Well, here is the Fisher equation, real yields. 10-year treasury yields less the year-over-year rate of change in the consumer price index. And you can see that real yields or inflation-adjusted yields have been falling since back in the mid-80s. Now, if we overlay treasury yields by itself, you can see as real yields in blue go down, treasury yields go down. Everyone's been saying that's not how it works, but that is exactly how it works. And what I've been saying is there's going to be a spike in real yields. You see it during recessions here. You see, in fact, almost in every recession, a spike in real yield. And I've said when this spike happens, it happens due to consumer prices. I'm trying to keep the mouse from bouncing around, but I'm not having, there it goes. That spike is caused by a massive drop in the consumer price index, and it's very bull, or that rise in, or the rise in the real yields is caused by a massive drop in the consumer price index, and it leads to a spike in bond prices because here you see a collapse in yields. Here you see a collapse in yields. Here you see a collapse in yields. And this is why I keep saying that yields are headed lower. This is the layup. If you understand how this plays out, you get what is coming. And even over the longer term, he says, look, it's still going to lead to lower bond yields, and that is higher bond prices. Diminishing returns occur when a factor of production, such as debt capital, is overused. This observation is confirmed by a decline in the marginal revenue product of debt. If you're not familiar with MRP, I encourage you to read this piece and, in fact, go look it up. He does talk about it in some of his prior reports. And then thus, considering decreasing interest rates as an inducement for governments to spend more borrowed funds will add to the severity of the debt spiral. Isn't that interesting? And then let's see. If policymakers are incentivized to borrow more because interest rates are low, then the marginal revenue product of debt will fall, leading to even weaker growth. And I've said this in the past, that governments should see low interest rates as a problem. They should actually try to run surpluses during periods of low interest rates. And when rates are high, they should borrow money. They see it completely backwards. And so right now, they see low interest rates as an incentive to borrow when they don't realize it is that borrowing that is leading to this problem. They're overusing debt. and they're expecting a different outcome. In fact, the markets believe there'll be a different outcome. All right, we're almost done with this section here. The low interest rates are not a potential benefit for the economy. They're a result of the overuse of debt. And remember, everyone wants higher interest rates. And then, you know, what happens is, the people email me, oh, Steve, look at this big treasury auction. Ha, the rates are going to go up. And I write back and I'm like, no, let them borrow more. You know, run a chart of 10-year treasury yields against the government debt shown inverted. You see, the more debt means lower interest rates. Borrow all they want. The more they borrow, the more it validates my view. All right, let's get to the last section where he talks about tail risk. And he identifies two tail risks to long-term treasury investors. Now, mind you, my thesis is toward the end of it, so I am not actually long-term on this position, but a new huge debt finance fiscal package, which probably at this point isn't going to come for a while, and a major change in the Fed's modus operandi. The first risk would change the short-run trajectory of the economy. This better growth, although short-lived, could place transitory upward pressure or short-term upward pressure on interest rates in a fashion we have seen. Over the longer run, disinflation would prevail and the downward trend in treasury yields would resume. Again, he's talking about people who are long-term, and my thesis were very close to the end of that first phase. And then he, on the last piece, he talks about the second risk would bring a rising inflationary dynamic into the picture, potentially becoming more consequential. General disappointment with trying to solve economic underperformance by more indebtedness may crystallize, along with the realization that debt will not work any better here than it did in Japan, Euro, or other countries, meaning that there could eventually lead to a change in the Federal Reserve Act. But he closes saying, as long as the federal government's policy prescription is ever higher levels of debt, the path toward disinflation will hold, and long treasury bonds will be the preferred area of the curve. So now you can see that, you know, in the first phase of my thesis, which, you know, years ago was a 3 to 5 year plan, which we're very, very close to the end of it, was all based on this whole notion. Now, even though I jokingly call myself the bond king, and many of you enjoy that as I do too, this is not long-term play. Phase one of my three-part thesis, almost at the end, but here's the key. I found the foremost expert on this area. Follow his research, follow him around, and not only do I just read it, break it down, and I hope as you read his report, and maybe go back and read some of his other reports and find interviews that Dr. Hunt's done, that you will find some value in this as you get to understand the bond market as well as I do. And I know if you take that time, you certainly will. So I want to appreciate you joining us today. As always, we'll be back on Wednesday to find out what we get from the beginning of earnings season, and we got the CPI data coming out tomorrow. And you can guess, I think that is peaking out or going to start to roll over. I'd be really curious to see. But what is the bond market telling you? It's not expecting a big number. I'm Steve Admeter. Thanks for watching. Bye now. The content of this video provides educational information only. It's not intended to provide investment or other advice. It is not to be construed as a recommendation or solicitation by any security, financial instrument, or to participate in any particular trading strategy. This video was prepared by Steve Admeter. Personal capacity is opinions expressed in this video that do not reflect the view of Atlas Financial Advisors, Inc. or Steve Admeter Financial.